We're going to continue in our study that we began several weeks ago in looking at the office of an overseer, that position that Paul wrote to Titus and said that he was to appoint in Crete, in every city. We first began to look at who those men were, noticing that overseers were the same as shepherds, were the same as elders. As we read various passages in the New Testament concerning those who have the oversight and the rule of the congregation, it is not a different set of offices or positions, but it's one group of men who would serve as those who give oversight to, those who shepherd and lead the congregation, those who do so not by their own will, but by the will of God. We looked at their work and how their work is primarily that of a spiritual nature. Their work is looking out for souls. If there were a passage that maybe describes the work of an elder, the work of a bishop in very succinct terms, maybe it's found in Hebrews chapter 13, in verse 17, where the saints are exhorted to obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls as those who must give an account. To watch out for souls, that is the primary work of elders. Everything that they do really has that in view, that in focus, of helping the saints to worship the Lord, to work for the Lord, to serve the Lord in this life in such a way that they could inherit that eternal life that the Lord has promised us. But not just any man can serve in that position. And it's not up to man to determine who can serve in that position. And so last week we began to look at who can serve in this role. And we looked at 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, just in that statement that Paul makes there, that if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. But who can serve in that role? It's not just anyone who would desire it. Well, we didn't go through 1 Timothy 3 last week or week before last. What we did was went back to Acts chapter 20, beginning in verse 28, where Paul, speaking to the elders at Ephesus, gave them a charge. And looking at what Paul told those men, we were able to see some things, some qualities that those men must possess in order to serve in that position. But this morning, I do want to take the time and look at primarily 1 Timothy 3. And at the end, what I would like to do is go back over to Titus chapter 1, beginning in verse 7. Much of what Titus is told by Paul is the same thing that he's written to Timothy about. There are a few things that Paul will tell Titus that he didn't specifically mention to Timothy. And so when we get through with what Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 3, I want to just look at a few of the things that he says to Titus that would be in addition. But what I want us to understand is what we find in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus chapter 1 is obviously not intended to be an exhaustive list of the qualities or characteristics of the men who would serve as elders. Notably missing from both lists, but an obvious requirement nonetheless would be that of humility. Now, there are certain elements of what Paul will say to Timothy and to Titus that you might could read in some humility there, but humility itself is not specifically mentioned, though who would doubt that a man who would serve as an elder or bishop need to be a humble man? So I use that just to say, as we go through these lists of things that are given to us in these two passages, don't think that that's it. It's just a sampling of the type of person who could serve as an elder. So looking at 1 Timothy chapter 3, we want to begin there in verse 1, where he says, "This is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work." And we won't spend a lot of time on this. We've noted it before. But when he says if a man desires the position of a bishop. It has to be the man's desire. Now, don't confuse this type of desire with the desire of a man to have rule, to have charge, to be the one who controls everything. There are a lot of men who desire the position, the title, the preeminence. But they don't desire what Paul is referring to here. They don't desire that position that the Lord has given as one who would watch out for souls. And so this desire, being different from that, is more of a desire recognizing that this is who the Lord has given charge. This is who the Lord, this group of elders, these bishops, this is who the Lord said should be over the congregation, overseeing the congregation, leading the congregation. And when we understand that, we understand that a church without elders is lacking, as we read in Titus 1:5, then we want that position to be filled. We want it to be filled by someone. And why not be filled by us? So the desire is not a desire for position, title, power. It's a desire to fulfill the work that God has given for man to do. And if I can fulfill that role, if I understand there is a need, then I ought to have that desire. I ought to have the desire to live as Christ has commanded us to live. And really, as we go through the list, we're going to find that's exactly what these qualifications are. It's just what the Lord would have any man to do who would be in the position that he's in. So, starting there, we understand there's the desire, but then more specifically, he says, then a bishop must be. And I want to take time just to say the word must is there for a reason. These are not suggestions. What Paul is going to write to Timothy about, he's not saying that, well, if you have men such as this, they would be the best suited for the work. But if you don't have men that would meet these qualifications, then just get the best ones you can find. Paul says that a bishop must be. And notice that he says be. Now, I mentioned this morning in our Bible class about the original language and dictionaries and things. I don't want to get carried away this morning looking at original language. I just do want to say this. The Greek language is very specific when it comes to tense, when it comes to mood, when it comes to singular or plural, a lot more so than the English language. You take a particular word in the Greek, and that word is the base word, but then depending on the tense, depending on the mood, what part of language it is, it'll have a different ending. And I don't intend to teach a grammar class here. All I intend to say is that when you go back and look at the words that are used, we're not guessing about this. The word is very specific, and the word that's translated be here is a present tense word. It doesn't say he must have been. You know, throughout looking to the past, this is the way he was. He says this is who he is right now. Now, it doesn't exclude some of the qualifications we're going to read show that his past is very important, has a lot to do with his present. But we're not just looking to the past at what a man has accomplished. We're looking at who he is right now. This man must be, and the first thing he says is blameless. Now, what I want to do is just go through and just kind of read through the verses. Then we're going to come back and look at each individual thing that's said. So he says that a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach. That comes from verses 1 and 2. Now, when we say blameless, that doesn't mean perfect. It doesn't mean that he's never sinned. It doesn't mean that right now there's no possibility of him sinning currently. The word blameless has the idea of one who maybe even being accused of something, but would stand acquitted based on the evidence. Jesus stood before Pilate blameless. But what happened with Jesus? He was convicted. The fact that he was convicted didn't mean that he was guilty of charge. He was convicted on false information. He was convicted by envious people who didn't care if they lied about him. They may have taken some facts, some evidence, and they twisted those things to try to make it look a certain way. But Jesus was blameless. Now, of course, Jesus was blameless in all things. He was completely perfect. Then you have the Apostle Paul. He was also tried. He was also accused of certain things that even witnesses came and gave testimony to. But Paul was blameless. Those things that were charged against him, they could not be proven. There was no evidence of what they were saying. So we're not saying that a man, that nobody would speak evil of him, that there's nothing that could ever be said about him. But when all the evidence is considered, what we will find is that this man is, he's blameless. He said, but he did sin. But he did commit this trespass in the past. Well, what did he do? Is he still living in that sin? Did he seek repentance? Has he changed? If so, then he can now be blameless because the blood of Christ would have washed away that sin. Now, being in Christ, we can be found justified and blameless in the sight of the Lord. If we are a Christian, if we are in the body of Christ, we all had better be blameless. There shouldn't be anything that someone could come and lay a charge against us that would stick. And so this man would have a good reputation. And I know we're going to see later that he speaks about a reputation among the world. Because there is that passage a little bit later in the text that speaks of his standing in the world, I think this would primarily indicate that this would be what the brethren would say about him, what the brethren know about him. You know, maybe he's blameless when we come together to worship, but how is he living his life? What do we see in other areas of his life? So as we go through each of these, the place to start, I fully believe, the place to start with each of these is just asking basically a yes or no type of question. Now, that doesn't mean that it's all black and white, that it's yes and no, and at the end, if we have more yeses than nos, then he'd be qualified. We're going to have to give some thought to certain things. But where do we start? Let's just start by asking some questions in relation to what is said and just getting a yes or no question. Is he guilty of a life of sin? Right now, currently, is that his standing? If yes, he cannot serve as an elder. If no, well, let's continue to see what is said. The husband of one wife. This one, a lot of debate has been said, and I don't want to suppose that I have all the answers to all the arguments that have been made. But I do think that if we're just going down through the list and we're just saying yes or no, it's a pretty easy question to answer. Does he have one wife? Yes or no? If he's not married, he doesn't have one wife. And again, we're talking about present tense. We're talking about his current situation. He doesn't say having been the husband of one wife. It says currently his state is that he is the husband of one wife. Does he have a wife? If he's not married, no, he doesn't have a wife. Well, what if he has been married in the past, but he put that wife away, and now he's married to another? Well, if he has put away his wife for a reason other than what the Scriptures allow, then no, he has two wives. He has a wife that he's still bound to legally by God, and he has another wife that he has taken that the law recognizes, but he doesn't have one wife. He'd have two at that point. So he could not serve. What if a man's wife died and now he has another wife? We'll answer the question. Does he have one wife right now? Absolutely he does, because that dead wife, she's no longer his wife. Romans chapter 7, beginning, first four verses, make it very clear. When a spouse dies, then we are no longer bound to that spouse. They're no longer our wife. If she were, then you couldn't take another wife because we can only have, in the eyes of God, one wife. So the husband of one wife, does he have one wife? Yes. All right, well, let's keep going. The word temperate is a word that's variously translated. One of the translations says vigilant. I think the King James says one who is vigilant. And that seems to be the idea of the word, one who is watchful. One of the definitions I found, one who is circumspect, that is one who who considers all things, that's looking about, and he's watching. Can you see how well this would help the man who is going to serve as an overseer for the Lord's body to be one who is temperate, who is considerate? There are several words that are going to be used that are very similar in nature. The word temperate sometimes is translated in other places as self-control, but we're going to find in Titus that self-control is specifically mentioned, so we'll talk more about that later. But just again, ask, is he watchful, vigilant? Is he circumspect? Does he see what's going on around him and then act accordingly? Well, that would be a man who is temperate. So if yes, well, let's keep going. Is he sober-minded? Does he have a sound mind? And this isn't just, does he ever get drunk? You know, that's going to be spoken to. But the idea of sober-minded is just of sound mind. And that might have to do with physical ability, but it also might have to do with just emotional state. There are some people who have the ability to be of sound mind, but they're just not. For whatever reason, maybe they've had their head too much in different types of literature that have pulled their minds in so many different ways, they just don't know what's going on. But to be sober-minded, it's, you know, they understand the seriousness of life. They understand the seriousness of the work that we're to be engaged in as Christians. And so their mind is not just constantly wandering and dreaming, but they're sober-minded of good behavior. Does his behavior reflect his mind? A person might be sober-minded. His thoughts might be gathered, but what is his life like? Well, if his life is guided by that sober-mindedness, then his behavior should be good. Well, if yes, well, let's move on. Hospitable. Does he love his neighbor as himself? Does he have a love for strangers? When Jesus is asked, well, who is my neighbor? He teaches the parable of the Good Samaritan. And at the end, he says, who was neighbor to him who fell among thieves? Well, the answer was pretty clear. It wasn't the priest. It wasn't the Levite. They saw a need and they ignored that need. But that Samaritan who came down the road not only saw the need, but he took care of the man and did all that he could do and then some to help that person. Well, that's the type. It's not just, does the man throw parties every once in a while? You know, I think sometimes we limit our idea of hospitality to, well, you got to have a party. You got to have people into your home and you got to feed them. That is a way to show hospitality, but that's not the only way and it's not the primary way that we show hospitality. When we see a need, are we willing to help take care of the need? As we look at all of these different things that are said by Paul, by the Holy Spirit, it's good to think about these things in terms of the work that's to be done by an elder. As an elder oversees the flock, as he shepherds the flock, do you think he's ever going to encounter a time when there's a need by someone that the church would have the responsibility to care for? Do you think there will be needs arise that the elders are going to have to meet and say, hey, what are we going to do about this? A man who is hospitable, a man who is used to recognizing needs, caring for needs as he can, then as he guides the church, he is also going to recognize needs and care for those needs as is lawful concerning what the church can do. But then himself, as an individual, he'll continue to display this type of life and that will help him in his work. Able to teach. The King James Version says apt to teach. Brother Bragwell, in talking about this, said that one time there was a discussion about a man, and it came up, well, is he apt to teach? And a man said, well, I believe he's apt to. And the idea was, you know, if the circumstances arose, I think he would. But that's not what apt to teach means. The New King James, I think, gives a good translation. Is he able to teach? Well, the answer to that one is pretty simple. Does he teach? How do you know if a man is able? Do we just ask him? Hey, could you teach? Yeah, I could teach. Okay, mark that one off. Well, no. If we know if he's able to teach, if he's done it. And that doesn't mean that he's had to stand right here and use the computer and the overhead and teach a quarter's worth of classes. Now, he really, I think, should be able to do that. He would be able. But that's not the teaching necessarily that's being referred to here. It's just the teaching of the gospel. Does he teach his neighbor? Does he teach his children? Does he teach himself? Does he help teach the congregation? Does he give lessons on Wednesday nights or Sunday evenings? Does he take the opportunities that he has to teach his co-workers? It's a man who has learned the gospel, and he is going to teach that gospel in any way that he can. So does he teach? Yes. Now, as we go through, we're asking yes and no questions. If at any point here we say no, well, we don't need to go any further. Because it's not a majority. It's not we're going to take the majority of the thing. If he does the majority of them, he'd be all right. He has to do, again, going back to the very beginning, a bishop then must be every one of these things. So if we've got yes, we'll keep going and let's see if he continues to meet these characteristics that are given. In verse 3, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. So, not given to wine. Does he drink? You know, that's a yes or no question. It's not a, well, he doesn't drink too much. Well, he only drinks on special occasions. Does he drink? You say, well, he drinks, but he's not given to it. You know, going back to the hospitality, some translations say given to hospitality. That is, that's what he does. That's the kind of person he does. That's the kind of work he does. That's the kind of person he is. Well, the same would be true about given to wine. Now, that doesn't mean has alcohol ever touched his lips. I don't believe that's the understanding. I don't believe we could prove that from the text. But is he a drinker? If it's social drinking, that doesn't change things. He still drinks. He's still given to wine. People will argue, and I don't want to get off into a complete lesson about drunkenness and drinking wine. I plan to address that coming up soon. But you know, there's never a drunker who didn't take his first drink. And so a man who's sober-minded, a man who's understanding the seriousness, again, in Hebrews chapter 13, there in verse 17, he's watching out for souls as one who must give an account. The soldiers in the days of Rome, if they lost a prisoner, they were killed. We see that in the case of Peter, when Peter escaped from prison in Acts chapter 12. Herod had the soldiers killed. When the soldiers lost the body of Jesus, now they were told they'd be protected. Protected from what? Protected from death, because if they lost the body, they'd be killed. They would suffer a great consequence. So do you think those soldiers would ever get drunk if they understood that a life was at stake, their own? They wouldn't even come close to that. And an elder watching out not only for his own soul, but for the souls of others, he's not going to drink. Is he violent? How does he react to conflict? How does he seek to settle an argument? You've met people, and maybe perhaps you have been the type of person, and I'll tell you, when I was younger, I was. You know, my first reaction was, you know, hey, let's put them up. We're going to fight this out, and the best man wins. But that's not who an elder is to be. He's not to be a brawler, a striker. Physical violence is not in him. That's not who he is. Not greedy for money. And this, some translations say, doesn't seek filthy lucre. And it's not just, he's going to talk about covetousness, but here it's not just a matter of loving money, it's how he seeks to obtain the money he has. Is he deceitful in his practices? Does he try to pull the wool over others? Does he try to take advantage of other people? Well, that's not the man you want looking out for the congregation of the Lord. Gentle. I think about an elder and his work, and people are going to need to come to him. People are going to need to share their problems with him, their sins with him, with them. Is he approachable? I've known men before, preachers and others, who they were not approachable. Maybe you try to approach them once, and that's all it takes to know that I don't want to go there again. Fathers can be that way. When we lash out, when we are harsh, well, that doesn't show someone that they're willing to work with us and help us. That creates fear. But someone who's gentle, someone who, that by experience you know that if this problem comes up, it's going to have to be dealt with. The consequences may be bad, but they're going to help me. They're going to be patient with me and help me through that. And so, you know, can he be approached without fear? Well, yeah, well, let's keep going. Not quarrelsome. Now, he's already talked about one who'd be a brawler or a striker, but you don't have to be a fighter to be quarrelsome. There are some people who are just so contrary, so contentious, that it doesn't matter. You know, they might start out on the same side as everybody else, but when they see that everybody else is taking the same position, well, they change positions just so they'd be contrary. Some people are like that. It seems you can't have a discussion with them without some type of argument, without them having to prove their superiority in their knowledge or whatever. But a person who's going to serve as an elder can't be that way. He's not looking for a quarrel. He's not looking for an argument. But we can answer that. Is he a contentious man? Well, yes or no? No, he's not. Well, let's keep going. Not covetous. This is maybe perhaps one of the areas that may be the hardest to see, or at least the hardest to honestly answer. You know, we want to think the best of everybody. Well, no, there are no covetous people among us. We don't have any problem with that. You know, where's your evidence? This is a heart check. You know, we're looking at a man's character. We're looking at his heart. What is his priority in life? And it's a question that we really can't answer. Just look at his life. Look at what he talks about. Look at what he engages in. Is it material or is it spiritual? What does he give his time to? What are all of his efforts about? If it's pursuit of the things of this life, it's very possible we've got a covetous man on our hands that could not serve as an elder. And thinking about these qualifications in relation to the work that's to be done by these men, can't you see how every one of these is going to be a detriment to any congregation if a man has any of these characteristics? He's going to be pulled. His focus is going to be on something different than what the Lord would have it to be. He's going to compromise. He's going to run people off. He's not going to be a loving, a caring shepherd. He'd be more like that hireling that if any danger comes, he's going to take off running. Certainly not a man who would lay down his life for the flock. All right, verses 4 and 5. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence, but gentle. But gentle is not supposed to be there. Take that out. I copied slides and I forgot to remove that section. Having his children in submission with all reverence, for if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Here's the verse. Here's the passage. Right? This is the one that everybody wonders about. Along with having one wife, this is probably the one there's the most discussion about. Ignore not covetous too. One who rules his own house well. There'll be a lot of men who rule their house. There are a lot of men who will let it be known, I'm the head of the house, I have the rule of this house, and it will be my way or the highway. That's not necessarily a bad thought process, but whose way is he insisting upon? Is it his way or the Lord's way? If he's ruling his house well, then it's the Lord's way. Now, with each of these, we could turn and we could look at a host of other passages and things that would help us to understand them. But this one, I do want to look at one other passage. And it comes from the book of Psalms. Psalm 127, in verse 1. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Unless the Lord build the house. So this man is going to rule his own house well, but it's going to be according to the will of the Lord. The Lord is going to be the maker of that house. And then he says, having his children in submission with all reverence. I want to borrow a little bit from what Titus says. I think Titus sums it up a little bit differently, but I absolutely believe he's saying the same thing. Titus says, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. And, you know, just going with the questions of the yes or no question, does he have faithful children? Of course, a lot of the questions surrounding this, does it have to be all of his children? I was discussing this passage with a friend of mine not too long ago, and they were asking, as a husband and wife, they were asking my thoughts about faithful children. It had to be all of them. And I suggested that, well, let's just start here. Let's just ask, faithful children, yes or no? Man has 5 children, 4 of them are faithful, 1 of them is not. Ask the question, does he have faithful children, yes or no? Yes, he does. He's got 4 of them, and they're great. You couldn't ask for more faithful children. Somebody said, but what about the one? What about the one? Does he have faithful children? Yes. Well, I suggested that to the couple. She said, the woman said, but what if you asked it this way? Are his children faithful? Then you couldn't just say yes. I said, I can say yes. His children, 4 of them are faithful. And she said, no, he couldn't. I asked her this. I turned the question around and I said, or actually asked a different question. I said, were Jesus' apostles faithful? Were Jesus' 12 disciples faithful? And she kind of paused for a minute and she said, yeah, but. I was like, just yes or no. Were they faithful? Yes, they were faithful. When he prays in John 17, he speaks of their faithfulness and how they were with him and stayed with him. Except for the one. Judas was not faithful. But that doesn't mean that Jesus wasn't a good teacher. It didn't mean that he didn't lead them in the right way. It didn't mean that on occasion he didn't take Judas aside and try to help him with his problem of covetousness and greed. But at the end of the day, Judas had his own free will. Well, as we're discussing, she said, well, but then you're making it a matter of discernment. You know, it's a matter of, you know, we get to decide. And I said, yes, that's why the passage is given to us. In Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 14, it talks about by reason of use, we have our discernment, our senses exercised to discern good and evil. God gave us a brain. He expects us to be able to take information and process that information and come up with an answer. She said, so you're saying it's just a matter of percentages. Well, when you go to the next question, for if a man does not know how, or the next statement, if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? You understand, we're making a determination. Did he rule his house well? That's the test. Well, how do you determine that? Well, she brought up the percentage. You're saying it's just a percentage. But you recognize percentages say something about our ability. There are farms all around here. I imagine when you look at these individual farmers, if you go around and you find out the yield, you know, what they're getting every year, there are some farmers who year after year have a much higher yield than other farmers. You know, you get a farmer that just goes out there, he throws a seed in the ground, he does the least amount of work, that gives the least amount of effort he can give to it, he's going to get something, but he's not going to get very much. And year after year after year, when you look at that, you're going to find that those percentages say a lot about those two men and who is a good farmer and who's not so good of a farmer. So when we're talking about ruling our house well, percentages, whether we like it or not, it tells us something. It gives us some information on how well they're doing. Now, can a man do everything? I understand we can't do it perfectly. But can a man do everything he could do, a man and a wife, husband and wife, in raising their children and children still go astray? Absolutely they can. Can a man do that and a majority of his children go astray? I suspect it's possible. But what we're looking at, and this is important to understand, what we're looking at here is not requirements for an entrance into heaven. What we're looking at is a requirement for men who will rule over the house of God. we need to have some solid, some concrete information to base our determination on. Are they capable of doing the work? And maybe as much or more than any other qualification given, this helps us to see how they have proved themselves. A couple of commentaries I was looking at throughout suggest when it began, husband of one wife. So that doesn't mean he has to be married. That just means if he is married, he's faithful to his wife. Having faithful, it doesn't mean he has to have faithful children, but if he has children, they'd be faithful. That's ridiculous. And I'll tell you why it's ridiculous. Because the reason stated for this, it's observable information that we can look at and see he can do the work. He's tested, and he's passed the test. And so if he doesn't have, if he's a single man without any children, what experience does he have in ruling anything that is going to help him to be able to rule the house of God? He doesn't have any. And therefore, he could not serve. So, again, does he have faithful children? Yes or no? Now, when you answer the question, yes, you still have to look a little deeper. My grandfather-in-law, Lisa's grandfather, was a good man. When I came along, when I met him, just you couldn't ask for a more faithful, God-fearing, conscientious man. He had three daughters who were very faithful. Two of them married to elders themselves. One of them married to a gospel preacher. Well, if you looked at that man, Jimmy Atkins, or James Atkins, could he serve as an elder? Oh, he's got faithful children, yeah. But what if you went back and found out that he wasn't even a Christian when his girls were at home growing up? He was baptized, if I remember correctly, he was baptized the same night Janet was, the youngest daughter. And so there's a man who, a good man, right now, currently, he has faithful children. But did he rule his house? Did he prove himself to be one who can rule? He didn't. His wife did that. Dolores did. Now, he was a good man even when he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't saved. And I imagine a lot of things he did contributed. But he would not serve as... Somebody brought his name up on several occasions to serve as an elder, and he would not. For this reason, he had not proven himself to have ruled his own house well. And I just bring that up to say, once you answer yes or no, we still have to use some discernment, some thought in deciding, you know, can he serve in that capacity? Verse 6, not a novice. And the reason given, lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. The word here for novice, it has the idea of youth. And it's not just a young person, but a youth in his faith. Is this a new convert? Someone who has not been experienced in the Christian realm very long? Well, that can be pretty easily answered, yes or no. And again, the reason there, lest being puffed up with pride, you fall in the same condemnation of the devil. The mature Christian who's going to serve as an elder is going to be faced with temptation. There are going to be issues to come up, problems that are going to put him to the test. Now, a young Christian, one who's not mature in his faith, you think about how much more difficult it would be to overcome those things. And so the indication is the devil, his problem was pride. His problem was he was puffed up too much with pride, and you see where that led him. Well, the same thing is very possible with one who is a novice who would be put into a position of an elder or a bishop. Verse 7, moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside. And the question then we ought to ask is, what is his reputation among those outside of the body of Christ? When we think about this, and let me get to where I got it highlighted. This is outside. This is not among the members here. What is his standing outside? Now, not everybody might speak well of him. But what's their basis? What's their evidence? Lest he fall into reproach and snare of the devil. It's not just a matter of what his reputation is. Who is he? You know, he could be one person here, but who is he at work? Who is he in other places? And so if you put a man into a position of an elder, bishop, or shepherd, pastor, it's not just that he's going to have a damaging reputation that would hurt the church overall. That is true. But again, lest he fall into the reproach and the snare of the devil. If he's not everything he should be, then it's going to give the devil more opportunity with him and with the congregation as a whole. So now real quickly, in Titus, things that weren't specifically mentioned in Timothy, not self-willed, a lover of what is good, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught. Not self-willed. Does he always have to insist on his way? The self-willed man, he's not looking out for the will of God. He's not looking, you know, at the will of others and what they're... It's all about him. It's about what his desire, what his will is, and he's going to push and push and push until he gets his way. That's the self-willed man. A lover of what is good, and that's a pretty easy question. What does he love? You know, I don't know. I think I'll ask him. You don't have to ask him. What does he spend? Who does he spend his time with? What does he spend his time on? What is his life about? When you look at that man, can you tell? What is it that he loves? Are those things good? Or are those things worldly? Is he just? And you know, it's fair and right. Most often the word that's translated just here is translated righteous in the rest of the New Testament. And it's just, does he want what's right for himself and for the congregation? Not just right based on what I think, but right in the sight of God. Is he holy? This is a word that's a little different than the word most often translated holy that means set apart. This has more to do with the idea of purity. Is he pure and moral in his way of life? Self-controlled. Does he ever show restraint? Does he always get what he wants? Does he always do what he wants to do? Or does he show a level of self-control and when there is something, maybe even something that would be fine, something that would be right, a desire? You know, I've known several people recently talking with someone. You know, there was an opportunity to do something. There was a desire there, but there was a recognition of something else that was more important that needed to be taken care of. He denied himself. He showed restraint. He showed self-control. Holding fast the faithful word as he has been taught. Does he hold to the truth, and not just in teaching, but in practice, regardless of the circumstances? An elder has to be able to do that. Again, not just in what he teaches, but in what he does. So when you look at all of that, you'd think, well, we couldn't ever think to get a man like that. We should have every hope of getting a man like that, because that's just a Christian. Not too long ago, we looked at a lesson on where do elders come from, and we found that they come from disciples. They come from committed men who have given themselves, been born again to Christ. And all of those things that we've looked at since that, they just come naturally with the man who is truly born again. And so we read a passage like Acts 14 and verse 23, that when Paul and Barnabas made their way back through those cities that they had visited as they went out, and it says that when they had appointed elders in every church, they prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. We don't have to wonder, how were they able to do that? They were able to do it because there were committed men and women there who were willing to serve God and serve the congregations among which they were part. And I hope we'll eventually find those men here and be able to have elders once again. If you're here and you recognize that any of those things that we've just looked at do not describe you, apart from a couple of them. I mentioned when we were talking about the children, that's not a checklist to go to heaven. There are those who, you know, think about Manasseh. Manasseh was a wicked man, did a lot of wicked things. He instilled those in his son Ammon. At the end of his life, Manasseh repented. And I have no doubt that Manasseh, if he remained faithful, could be with the Lord in the end. But now his son Ammon was going to continue in sin, as was apparent. We can't change what we did in the past. So some of those things with the children, or maybe even having the one wife, maybe not married, but the rest of what we looked at, if you don't meet those standards, then there are issues between you and the Lord, and you need to make those things right. If you're not a part of the body of Christ, then you have the opportunity this morning. Don't know that you'll have the opportunity this afternoon or tomorrow. Take the opportunity you have now to make things right with God if you need to. If there's any way that we could help you, would you come while together we stand and sing?